This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. The election season has now been going on for more than a year. And while the candidates make lots of speeches about taxes, job creation, or international trade, there's one topic that you didn't or don't hear about much on the campaign trail, and that's science. It certainly gets it certainly didn't play a role in the primaries, but might there be more of a science focus in the general election? Maybe even some science questions during the three scheduled debates. What science question would you want to ask the candidate? Not a quiz question to trip somebody up, like, you know, why is it hotter in the summer than the winter? Very few people know that. But an actual question about the issues. Our number, 844-724-8255. Sean Otto has been involved in this in a long time. He's a science writer and chair of ScienceDebate.org. His new book is The War on Science. He joins us from NPR Studios in St. Paul. And way back in 2008, he tried to get science questions introduced, calling his efforts Science Debate 2008. Welcome back, Sean. Good to talk to you.
Thanks, Ira. Happy to be here.
Have you had any more success than back then in getting science questions into the debate?
No, we haven't. It's not just us. You know, if we looked at it back then and we saw that, the candidates had been asked about 2,975 questions and hardly any, just six were about, for instance, climate change out of those 3,000 questions in 2008. Flash forward 8 years, and the Democrats and Republicans held a presidential debate, each of them, within a week after the Paris Climate Accords, big international agreement featuring 195 countries, and not a single journalist in either debate asked the candidates about climate change. So I think that the situation hasn't really improved.
Is the problem with the journalists, or is it with the topic material?
I think it's a little bit of both. When we've talked to journalists and news directors, they've often thought of it as a niche topic. So we decided to do some science on that, and we worked with Research America, and the two of us working together commissioned a national poll to hear voters' views on this. And it turns out that 87% of voters think that the candidates for president ought to be well-versed in science and ought to be able to talk about these issues in a public forum.
Now, let's talk about give us a handful of some of the questions you'd like to ask.
Well, as you said at the top, these aren't about trick questions like the details of cell mitosis or the fourth digit of pi or something like that. They're about the big policy challenges that the candidates for president, no matter who's elected, no matter what their party, they're going to face these things when they're in office. So it is things like climate change or how are you going to continue to power the American economy forward using science and innovation, which is responsible for over half of the economic growth of the United States since World War II. How are we going to balance privacy and security on the internet? What are we going to do about the rise of antibiotic-resistant superbugs that are threatening to end some of medicine as we know it? So these questions are broad, and they impact collectively voters' lives at least as much as the economic policy or the foreign policy or the faith and values issues that you often hear candidates sharing with journalists on the campaign trail. So we contend that they really need to be talking about these issues as well.
Considering how important the Senate race is shaping up this season, would you like people to question locally, not just wait for the presidential debates, but at their local congresspeople, senators, congressmen running in their hometowns?
Oh, absolutely. You know, and one of the things that this does, people, by the way, they can find the questions at sciencedebate.org/20questions. And one of the things that this does is beyond getting a candidate to answer on the content, it also reveals something about their respect for the role of evidence in their decision making, because it's evidence in America that's the foundation of justice. It's evidence that the founders relied on when they crafted the Declaration of Independence to argue that all of us are created equal.
How can you influence the people who are going to be asking the questions in the presidential debate? Do you have to go to the candidates themselves, or do you go to the people conducting the panel, the moderators, get them interested in this?
Well, we don't know who the moderators are going to be yet. We have reached out to all four major presidential campaigns this time, and we've gotten somewhat receptive response from most of them. We're hopeful that they're going to be engaging with us. Mm-hmm. But one of the other things that we've done this time, and this is not just sciencedebate.org, this is a broad coalition of the American science enterprise, including the National Academies, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, AIBS, the American Chemical Society, IEEE, a lot of people. And collectively, we're really pushing journalists to start asking these kinds of questions and including them when they encounter candidates on the campaign trail. And by those means, we hope that journalists will begin to inject them into the debates as well.
Okay, let's see if we can get some listener feedback. Let's go to Goldsboro, North Carolina. Hi, welcome to Science Friday. Hey there.
Hi, Ira. How you doing?
Hi there.
I was what I'm curious about, and it's a great topic because I have probably seven or eight questions I'd love to ask the candidates. But
give me one.
One that NASA. Where would NASA fit into the budgets and space exploration? How would what do the candidates feel about that?
Mm-hmm. Okay. What do you think?
That's a great question, and it's the number 16 of our questions, that there's a political debate over America's national approach to space exploration and use, and what should America's national goals be for space exploration and Earth observation from space?
Mm-hmm. You know,
and what steps would your administration take?
Yeah. You know, I think that people normally are assuming that the public is not interested in questions about science.
Well, that's a problem that we've encountered over and over again. And I think it's because most of the political class and most of the political journalists, their last exposure to science was in high school, and they didn't like it very much. And they went into the humanities, they went into journalism, or they went into law, and they haven't had to deal with it since, and they're very happy in that world. But that's not the world we're living in anymore. You know, over the next 40 years, we're going to create as much new knowledge as we have in all of recorded human history. So we've simply got to find a more robust way for incorporating the advances from science into our policymaking dialogue so we can continue to govern ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Do you still see in your surveys that the evolution creation debate is still very hot among people and among politicians?
Absolutely. We don't ask it because it doesn't really rise to the level of the presidential debates, because the president can't really prescribe policy about teaching of evolution or creationism in science classes. But it is a good barometer for the relative role of ideology or evidence and how what that plays in a policymaker's thinking.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Phoenix. Hi, Mateo, is it?
Mateo.
Mateo, sorry.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Fine, how are you? Go ahead, please.
Good, thanks. I just had a question. Insofar as we could be doing more to ask presidential candidates to entertain questions about science and perhaps science and technology, one of the things that we might look at in terms of having them answer our questions is where they see investment in science and technology helping us to further democratize our public institutions, whether that's higher ed or something else.
Mm-hmm. Good question, yeah, Sean.
I think that philosophically that's really strikes to the core of what we're talking about, this idea that public policy, when available, ought to be based on evidence. And if there is evidence, somebody's well-held opinion shouldn't be trumping it, because it's the evidence from nature that really determines what's really going on and what's most fair to the majority of people.
Mm-hmm. And you said you have submitted these questions already to the candidates, the remaining candidates?
Yes, we have. Yes, a couple of days ago on the 10th.
On the four of the candidates from all the different parties.
Yes. This is an unusual election cycle, as you know, Ira, and a lot of media are covering all four campaigns, and we thought that it would be an important discussion to see the views of the Green Party and the Libertarian Party candidates as well, since a number of voters are considering them as alternative candidates. So we thought it was an important contrast.
Mm-hmm. Do you find that when you bring up the topics, I mean, and you ask the candidates, that you get them to think about it for the first time, and maybe they say, hey, you know, this might be important to talk about?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, that's exactly what happened in 2008. You know, when we first started out, President Obama was not particularly pro-science in his rhetoric or in his approach. In fact, he tried to avoid our effort for quite some time. But then once he embraced it and agreed to answer the questions and formed a science advisory committee, we really saw a change in his approach. And he provided outstanding answers, but he also seemed to embrace the idea of science and evidence as a core strategic value for his administration. And in fact, he wound up appointing five of our core early supporters to cabinet-level positions, including the presidential science advisor, the energy secretary, the director of NOAA, the director of U.S. Geological Survey, and the director of the National Cancer Institute. So I think that just having the discussion and putting the pressure on candidates to talk about this does push them in a healthy direction for the country.
Let me get a last question here from Salt Lake. Michael, hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hey, thank you very much. My question, and it's more of a question comment, and I'd like to preface this by saying that I am strongly in support of more scientific talk in the political realm, but I do feel a lot of the responsibility for the lack of science talk lies with the scientific community itself. I mean, I don't see there's no science, you know, political PAC. I don't see science political advertising. I don't see the scientific associations donating to different candidates. Like, I work in politics, and I feel and somewhat frustrated by the fact that I don't feel the scientific community actively engaging in the political process. And then they're aghast when, you know, no journalists or the public don't seem that interested in the subject.
Is Sean running out of time? Question? Answer?
Well, you're absolutely right. In fact, I address that in my new book called The War on Science quite extensively, how the scientific community post-Sputnik and the funding of the NSF really withdrew from the public conversation. But that's changing now. This is the scientific community speaking here, getting behind the sciencedebate.org initiative. And I think that over the near term, we should be able to see some positive movement in that direction.
Sean Otto, chair of sciencedebate.org, author of the new book, The War on Science. And you can go to his website and find out the 20 questions that they're going to be asking the candidates. Thanks for taking time to be with us today. We're going to take a break and come back right after this. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Imagine you're a spy who has been captured carrying a device full of classified military data. If the bad guys get a hold of the information, well, you know what can happen. But what if the device that stored that data could dissolve in water at a moment's notice, like an Alka-Seltzer tablet? That is the dream of a group of researchers in the emerging field of transient electronics to create devices that self-destruct for the purpose of keeping military secrets out of enemy hands, or devices that dissolve in your body after their useful life is over. So get used to that term, transient electronics. You're going to be hearing a lot more of it. Unfortunately, scientists and engineers are still a wee bit away from developing something as sophisticated as a dissolving hard drive or a smartphone. But researchers from the University of Iowa are at least one step closer. They have successfully created a lithium-ion battery that could one day power some of those potential devices. And Reza Montazami is here, an assistant professor of mechanical engineering at Iowa State University. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Ira. Great to be on the show.
Tell us about this. Let's start from the beginning. What are these things called transient electronics?
Because they have a predefined and well-designed lifespan, unlike conventional electronics that are usually built to last a very long time. Transient electronics are designed to perform a specific task over a given period of time, and the hope is to make him disappear after that period of time is over.
Well, why don't we just blow them up like we do things now?
Well, that is one option. Of course, if you are working with bioelectronics or biomedical devices, you don't want to blow it up in someone's body. So that is one drawback, because you may also hurt the person who has this piece of electronic in their body. And also, when you blow up something, or if you, for example, break something or shatter something into pieces, there are going to be some remains, or at least there are going to be some signs of that explosion or that whatever mechanism that triggered that destruction. In case of transient electronics, the hope is not to leave anything behind. So even if once your piece of electronic is destructed, the hope is that if mm-hmm. someone goes to that site, they won't know that there was a device here.
So you've taken the first step. You've redesigned the lithium ion battery so that it self-destructs in, what, 30 minutes?
Yes.
How does
approximately
it,
30
so
minutes.
What kind of engineering does it take for that? Do you have to just adapt a current lithium ion battery, or do you have to start over from scratch?
Both are possible. Actually, there are a version of transient batteries that use a different chemistry than lithium iron batteries chemistry, but usually the output potential or the voltage is lower because you're using a different sort of salts and ions, so it undergoes a different chemistry and delivers a different voltage, which is usually lower. So far has been always lower. What we did, we tried to work off the conventional active materials in a lithium iron battery. So, for example, the material we use for our cathode and anode and electrolyte are very similar to those in your cell phone battery or any or your laptop battery or any other lithium ion battery that you may find in the market. So we took those materials and took their chemistry to make them transient. And these materials are not water soluble by default. So we had to come up with a new approach of what we call the hybrid chemical physical transiency approach, which takes advantage of some soluble materials and some insoluble materials that are deposited from either a nano or a micro dispersed solutions, and then the particles are redispersed in the solvent, in our case water. So some of the components don't actually dissolve, but they are redispersed in form of nano and micro particles.
So does it self-destruct, or do you need to drop it in water for it?
You need to drop it in water.
Yeah.
And so, actually, self-destruction is our next step, something that can be remotely activated. That's the next step.
So the idea would be to create a device that when it self-destructs, you don't even know it had been there in the first place.
Yes. Yes. That's,
wow.
That's the general idea.
How close? Do we have an application for your first battery, how to use it? Is someone paying to say, hey, give me one of those. I know how to make something out of that.
Well, the research is at the fundamental stage. So we are mainly trying to just learn and hopefully master this technology. The applications will come after this stage. Basically, the engineering would happen after we have mastered the technology, because for a device to be fully functional, there are many working components. One of those components is the battery that provides the source of energy. About 2 years ago, we had a transient antenna that could receive a radio signal, but then it was connected to other non-transient equipment in our lab. So it was just the antenna that was transient. So that was the first step. So in order to have something that is fully functional and basically self-sustaining, there is a long way.
I'm sure the military is interested in this for obvious reasons. Have you had any work with them or heard from DARPA?
Have
people heard from DARPA that they'd like something like this?
No, actually, DARPA had two calls for this type of technology. The first call was more on the fundamentals that was basically before we start working on this, or probably was at the same time, so we didn't have enough preliminary data to submit a proposal. The second call, which was last year, was on a... if I remember correctly, on an airplane or a glider that can deliver a package or a parcel to a specific location and then dissolve, and then it only as much as a tennis ball could remain at the site. And that is, again, more toward the application. Our approach is more toward the fundamental mm-hmm. understanding and fundamental mm-hmm. science of it.
So all the secrets in that glider or whatever would just go away with the dissolving of the object
yes,
itself.
The idea was that the glider itself is also, you can deliver a package or a parcel to somewhere, and then your delivery mechanism is disappearing.
Mm. Wow. Fascinating. We're gonna add that phrase to our vocabulary, transient electronics. We'll be watching out for you, Reza. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Reza Montazami is Assistant Professor of Mechanical Engineering at Iowa State University. Right now in Rio, they're in the thick of the 2016 games, but it's in just over a week. The excitement will be over. The crowds will have gone. All that will be left is billions of dollars worth of new infrastructure, including $38 million spent on a 20,000-seat Olympics aquatic stadium, a venue Rio couldn't even come close to filling again. The white elephant is a problem that every host city faces, but one for which Rio has come up with a creative solution. Joining me now to talk about it is Sam Lubell. He's a contributing writer for Wired. Welcome to Science Friday, Sam.
Thanks, Ira.
This is always the problem with Olympics, villages, or World's Fairs. I know here in New York, we still have buildings left over from the 36 World's Fair, right?
Well, that is definitely
39
true.
39 World's Fair, yeah.
Any big event, the challenge is, of course, you need to accommodate many, many people. But after that, you're not going to have those crowds anymore. So what do you do with those buildings after everybody leaves?
And what does Rio have in store for its Olympic infrastructure after the Games?
Well, Rio is following a trend that the International Olympic Committee sort of set an initiative to sort of change this white elephant problem. That certainly Athens and Beijing are two of the poster children for empty Olympic parks that have ghost-like buildings sitting there empty or mostly empty. So the idea. Rio is really focusing on a few stadiums that are not going to be that way at all. They're calling them nomadic stadiums. And the idea is, once you're done with the games, you don't just take the stadium apart and then it's done. You take the stadium, which is something that London really really initiated in the last Olympics. But in this case with nomadic, you take it apart and then you build it somewhere else as something completely different. So, for instance, the handball arena is going to become four schools scattered around Rio, and the aquatic center that you mentioned will become two community pools outside of the main Olympic area.
So are they doing this in advance now? Or, you know, Tokyo is going to be the next Summer Olympics.
Right.
Is Tokyo thinking about this in advance of how they might use their buildings later?
They call it the legacy mode, and it's something that every Olympic Games are thinking about. And I think it seems like there's now two major kind of strategies, I think, that are really making things a little bit more sustainable after the games leave. One is what we're talking about here. You have these lightweight stadiums that can either be taken apart or kind of taken down from like 80,000 seats to 20,000 seats because you're not going to need 80,000 seats, or nomadic. So these really lightweight prefabricated structures. And then you have what actually Los Angeles is proposing for the 2024 games, which is basically the idea of not building anything at all, using stadiums that exist already. That's, some people say, well, that's the greenest thing of all, is to not build anything at all, you know, repurpose. I think Tokyo is looking at probably a combination of that. They have they headed the games, you know, in the mid-century already, and they have a pretty extensive list of stadiums that are there already. So they're going to have a mixture there. But LA is really looking to almost build nothing.
Wow, so you just use the stuff you have. Can you expand it? I mean, do they have an 80,000?
You can. The Coliseum. It's hosted a couple of Olympics, but it needs to be retrofitted. It's bakes in the sun. There's no shade, so they're already building shade structures there. Actually, because the Rams will part time be there until they get their own stadium moving to LA. But they can retrofit and change stadiums around, but it's still more sustainable than building something from scratch.
Yeah. Our number 844-724-8255 if you'd like to talk about the Olympics and what happens to the buildings there. Does the IOC, the International Olympic Committee, now require you, if you're a city, to become a home city, that you come up with a plan for recycling your buildings?
Well, it's not. As far as in my research, I couldn't tell that it's necessarily – It's absolutely required, but they've made it very clear in their documents to potential cities that it's something they're looking for. So basically, if you're applying to become a host city now, and if you want to get it, you're basically going to need to do one of these strategies to get the games.
And you know, it makes sense because, for example, Brazil, when Rio originally planned for their games, Brazil was actually in great financial shape, right?
A little different, yes.
A little different than it is today, but. Now that they have buildings they can repurpose, that might be on the higher side than where they might have been if they hadn't.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think the idea of now that these stadiums, which, again, you know, what do you, an 80,000-seat, 50,000-seat arena just sitting there empty, you know, it's not going to help the community. But if you have these new schools that you're building out of it, that, obviously that's something that they're going to need. So it makes a lot of sense. I think it's a great idea.
Let's talk about how London or L.A. is compared to this. Let's talk about London. London has really thought this through.
Oh, yeah.
When they start.
Oh, London still is getting, for the most part, getting really good reviews for the way they handled the games. And it was a lot of it was in response to previous games, which did not get quite as good reviews in the way they handled the legacy mode, as I'm saying. So quite a few of those stadiums in London were either able to be, as I said, taken down completely or taken down from like 40,000 to 20,000. The one big exception actually is the big Olympic Stadium. Because the Olympic Stadium was supposed to be, I think it started at 80 and was supposed to go down to something like 20.
Right.
But the economic downturn hit the entire world. Right. You know, basically they decided that once the games after they happened, they actually now rent it out to a soccer team and they never shrunk it. It's now it's still the full size and they get the money from hosting giant soccer games there.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. Talking with Sam Lubell, contributing writer for Wired and co-author of the forthcoming book, Never Built New York. And I want to talk about your forthcoming book about Never Built, because you have studied a lot of architecture that I understand never got built in New York.
Yes.
Is there something to learn about never getting built in the Olympics that you learned from, you know, researching your book and some lessons there?
Well, it's a good question. There's always a lot of lessons from things that were never built. Sort of a now an expert in failure, I guess, is what I like to say.
The Robert Moses knot of New
York
City.
Yes. Well, and that's a good lesson for. I mean, the New York has tried to get the Olympics. The most recent one was a. They actually put together a pretty good scheme when they didn't win when they recently were trying for the Olympics, but. They were really interested in repurposing and doing what London did later. And I think London, this is something, a phenomenon that Never Built shows a lot, is people take, I don't know if they actually took it one-to-one, but it gets into the water. This idea that for the New York Olympics, they wanted to build the Olympic Village to really redevelop Queens near the waterfront.
Yeah, and the idea, where the World's Fair used to be.
There was parts of it was by the World's Fair. The Olympic Village was going to be basically right near the waterfront, near sort of that no man's land where you get when you take the train over the water.
Near City Field and things.
Yeah, like yeah. And they were going to really make an effort to, with the Olympic Village, they were going to make it into housing afterwards. They were going to make it sort of the ability to repurpose it after the Games was really a big part of that plan. They didn't win it, but then London really used the Olympic Games to redevelop an area of theirs, which is the east side of London, that was historically underserved and sort of not in the best shape. And that's, you know, that's a plan that now is almost considered something mandatory.
Do you win points with the Olympic Committee if you have a forward-looking plan?
Definitely.
Like that?
Definitely.
Yeah?
The Olympic Committee is looking for that. And as somebody that covers architecture, I see that architecture and design, urban design, are becoming more and more of a enticement for the Olympics. And you know, you look at the proposals; they're getting so elaborate. They're spending millions and millions of dollars on these renderings, and soon I'm sure it's going to be virtual reality fly-throughs, and you're going to be able to see what the games are like. And it's a huge part of getting the games.
As someone who covers architecture, how would you rate the Rio architecture compared to other Olympic attempts?
I think that some of it is really interesting. I love this nomadic idea. I think it's great. Some of those stadiums, they're not architecturally, they're not things that, you know, like the bird's nest in Beijing that the firm Herzog and Demeron did was spectacular architecturally, but not, you know, now it's sitting empty for the most part. Yeah. There's a few things, so it's, you know, it's this hulking mass, whereas these are, you know, not quite as impressive architecturally, but they're lightweight, they're prefabricated, they can be taken apart, they can be moved around, they're much more flexible. So sometimes an aesthetic, you know, an aesthetic wow in the long term is not a great idea. Yeah. So I think, and Rio does have some pretty wow stadiums. A lot of them are actually from the World Cup that they had a couple of years ago, which they got a lot of flack for building a lot of new stadiums that didn't necessarily. So they sort of learned their lesson.
I'll have to resurrect the Men in Black facilities over at at the World's Fair site.
Yeah, we'll talk another time.
You know those two towers
yes,
I'm talking about.
You'd be surprised what they've proposed
right.
for there.
We're going to have you come back with you, but when is your book coming out?
It's in October. I'd love to.
All right, we'll have you come back. Sam LaBelle, contributing writer for Wired and co-author of the forthcoming book, Never Built New York, because I can't wait. I love talking about New York City architecture.
Well, I look forward to it, and
thanks
thank
for
you so
taking
much.
Time to be with us. We're going to take a break and talk about whether machines are beating humans in the job market. Has automation finally arrived, putting people out of work? We'll have a couple of discussions, a couple of people discuss it when we come back after this break, so stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. It's been a common idea since the dawn of the industrial age. Machines taking jobs away from people that used to do them. Remember? We call that automation. And the beat goes on. Speakers at the World Economic Forum this year said, quote, about 7 million jobs will be lost, 2 million gained as a result of technological change in 15 major developed and emerging economies. Have we reached that point where more jobs are being lost than created by machines? Certainly machines do excel at some jobs, and there are jobs where human labor is still invaluable. And as machines and robots and the Internet of Things technology continue to improve, what does the future of work look like? That's what we're going to be talking about. Our number 800-844-724-8255, 844-724-TALK. You can also tweet us at SciFry. James Manyika is a senior partner at McKinsey & Company. He is a director of the McKinsey Global Institute in San Francisco. He was one of the authors of a recent article analyzing which industries are and are not becoming automated. He joins me from KQED in San Francisco. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you, Ira. Glad to be here.
Howie Chostad is a professor of robotics at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and you may have seen some of his snake-like bio-inspired devices. He also works on medical robots. Welcome to Science Friday.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
James, you looked across industries at where automation has really taken hold and where it might be in the future. And what did you find there?
Well, this is very interesting, Ira, because what we did was we took an activity level analysis and looked at something like 800 occupations across the U.S. economy. And what we found is that if you take an activity view, something like 45% of activities that are being done in the economy could be automated with already demonstrated technology. But if you translate that into, how many whole jobs could be automated, we found that the estimate, at least for the foreseeable future, for the near future, was about 5%. But this is the thing that was quite interesting, Ira, which is even though we may not see, at least in the next decade, whole-scale automation, we did find that something like 30% of activities in about 60% of jobs could be automated. So in other words, the jobs will actually change quite dramatically.
So what happens to the people who normally would do those jobs? I mean, the skill set level of those people, can they find other jobs doing other things?
Well, first of all, the people who are not likely to be totally replaced, they'll find that they'll be working a lot more with machines. Mm-hmm. In other words, machines will complement some of their activities, the 30% that I mentioned. And so those people are going to need to be competent, or the machines are going to have to be designed in such a way that the people can work with them. But I think to the question of people who may find their whole occupations automated, the roughly 5%, it's actually important to note that most of those are actually going to be in the middle skill category. And in that category, the middle skill category, the rates of automation may actually be as high as between 15 and 20%. So that'll be the hardest hit group. And I think
What kind of jobs are we talking about there?
So these are jobs that typically have three characteristics. There's a lot of data processing involved. There's a lot of data collection involved. And or they're working in highly structured environments. So think about somebody working on an assembly line in manufacturing, or think about a clerk who's capturing accounting records, for example. Mm-hmm. So these are all jobs where there's a lot of data processing involved, and there's a lot of data collection involved, and you're working in a highly structured environment, which is very easy to automate.
Mm-hmm. You're a roboticist. Where do you see the future here?
So I see the future with robots creating jobs, empowering the American workers on today's jobs. I think we have only begun to really see the true potential of what technology can do for employment and for productivity.
Mm-hmm. Give me an example, for example.
So, for example, we use one of the automation companies with whom we work. They want to use these robots called collaborative robots, robots that work in close proximity to people and with people at the same time, in order for that person to carry out his task. Not only will he carry it out more quickly, they're actually more concerned about the quality of the task that this person will be able to carry out. Fewer errors, it's safer, and it's more ergonomic for the person as well.
Yeah, no, you brought up safety. I always think of one of the great advantages robots have is that they can go and work in unsafe places.
Yes, one of the benefits of robots is that they can get into hard to reach, difficult places to do tasks that people shouldn't be doing, like in a nuclear power plant disaster, for example. In this case here, what I mean by safety is that a worker, working on a line, often they have to reach into configurations that are just hurtful to their bodies. They're not ergonomic. Now with this robot that's both a tool and a partner, they can carry out the task and it still be ergonomic. They're not going to get hurt. They're going to be more safe.
Is that sort of something like your snake-like robots get into hard-to-reach places?
Well, I do have a bias that I like thinking about snake robots getting to highly constrained spaces to do inspections and repairs and assembly tests. But yes, that would be an example.
Mm-hmm. Our number 844-724-8255. Let's go to the phones. People, some interesting ideas. Let's go to San Francisco and Alder. Hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, thank you for letting me on. I'm a really big fan of the program.
Well, thank you. Go ahead with your question.
So certainly. So actually, right here in San Francisco, I'm creating jobs through automation. We run 3D printing shops. So I'm actually curious about the guests. Like, with us, we're using 3D printers to make things locally instead of sourcing the jobs overseas. I was wondering what the guests thought about how, this might, granted, we're taking jobs away from, over in China, but we're actually bringing them back to America. So I was wondering about your thoughts on that.
James Manyika?
Well, I'm actually very excited about the potential for 3D printing in terms of what it might do to fueling a renaissance, if you like, in manufacturing. So I think what you're describing and you're working on is tremendous because it's going to enable more individuals to be able to participate in manufacturing. So I think that's a good thing. And I also think it's important to go back to something that Howie said, which is one of the things that we should think about when we come to these questions of automation is that quite often the output is actually better. In other words, it's not just about matching what humans can do, but it's also about going beyond that in many cases. Less errors, more perfection, better outputs, better products. So I'm actually quite supportive and I think I'm excited about the possibilities of 3D printing.
Do you ever see robots taking the place of where the human touch is needed, like in caregiving, hospitals, nursing, things like that? Howie, do you think that those are places that are, they really need a real person?
So in caregiving, obviously you need a real person for that kind of relationship. But I do view us developing intelligent technology, robotic tools that can do some of the more mundane tasks that I don't think the caregiver wants to deliver, nor I think the patient wants to receive from a person. Certain kinds of bathing and cleaning, for example. I think a person would rather be able to do it himself with a mechanism than having another person come in and clean him.
We hear of and we know of robotic surgery going on. I mean, it's not going to put surgeons out of business, is it?
Oh, no. What we're doing is, and this is a common theme, we're democratizing the ability to deliver medical care. Now, with robot surgery, as an example, we're offloading a lot of cases that surgeons may not even want to do. They want to do the special, the more complicated work. That's why they're surgeons. We can offload them to non-surgeons who can now deliver the same level of care, and I might add, not only minimally invasively, so it hurts less, but also at a lower cost, and not requiring all the infrastructure that you would need in a hospital. So now you have a situation where robotics, surgical robotics, are creating jobs for medical care to be delivered, and more medical care can be delivered at a lower price. So everyone benefits.
Mm-hmm. Well, in fact, if I could just add one point to that, Ira, if I may. I mean, I think there's a useful historical analogy to what Howie's just describing. Think about the bank teller, right? So the job of the bank teller 3-4 decades ago involved helping you get money out of your savings account. Well, we automated that part of it. And it doesn't mean that bank tellers went away. In fact, people were predicting that there'll be no more bank tellers. But what actually happened is the opposite. So the role of what a bank teller is changed quite dramatically to doing these higher order, if you like, human interactions and other functions that didn't involve simply helping you get money out. In fact, the number of bank tellers went up, mostly driven by the fact that there was more demand. We opened more branch banks. And so the number of people working as bank tellers actually went up.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, as we create robots, we also will need to create the software, the artificial intelligence, just the code that has to be programmed into these robots. So there are, is that a job gain there?
So,
oh, absolutely.
That regard,
Sorry, go ahead.
So in that regard, not only are we creating jobs because we've empowered the American worker, but we're also creating jobs for people to deploy, maintain, and perhaps operate these robots. And these are are fine jobs to have. On top of that, we're also creating lots of jobs for software developers, higher level thinking and creativity to make our mechanisms that much more capable.
We now have lots of websites, videos, whatever, that teach people things, but they're not teachers. Are we going to be replacing teachers, or do teachers have a special place because they're in schools, they're more hands-on with the students? What do you think about that, James?
Well, I think when we did our analysis, I think teachers were actually in the category of the least likely to be automated for most of the reasons you just described. Because keep in mind that one of the things that's quite fascinating on this question of jobs and automation is that you sort of have to think through four or five different factors. One is the question of technical feasibility. Can you actually technically automate the task? But there's a whole other set of considerations, the cost of doing that, the alternative labor supply dynamics, the benefits of doing that, but also the social acceptance. I mean, there are things that we I think, in a social sense, think ought to be done by humans. So I think when you take all that into account, education and teachers and a lot of caregiving are likely to be things that we're going to, at least for the near term anyway, want to have humans do that.
Mm-hmm. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking about robotics and about automation, old topics we've been talking about for over 100 years, about what's the workplace going to be like. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Pittsburgh, PA. Matt, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, yeah, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Go ahead.
So I work for a delivery company. I won't name them, but they don't have any infrastructure in the area. I just work through the app, so it's kind of like my job is working under a robot already. So hearing this segment kind of just made me think about, well, first of all, delivery jobs probably won't be there in the future because it's an obvious place for automation. And second of all, it's kind of different when you don't have a boss that you talk to every day and you just sign into an app and, like, get punished through the app or have to call off through the app. It's a little different.
Now, tell me, wait a minute. What do you mean you get punished through the app?
Well, the app will be like, oh, you didn't pick up that order fast enough. Like, what happened? And then they'll be like, if I don't make the order on time, then I don't get paid the full amount that I'm owed.
And you have no recourse to go to your boss because there's no boss sitting in the office next door.
Yeah, exactly. The boss is in Philadelphia. They don't have any infrastructure in the Pittsburgh area.
Wow. Let me ask my guests. Howie, what do you think of that, James? Are you guys there?
Yeah.
So one of the... So go ahead, Howie.
Oh, please. You please go ahead.
Now, I was going to say, one of the things that, to the caller's point, one of the tasks that's actually very hard to automate, at least in the work that we looked at, was the idea of managing and goal setting and the kinds of things that managers do. So while the task may be easy to complete in the way that the caller is describing, the whole process of managing and setting goals is actually very difficult. So there is something lost when, in fact, as the caller describes, there's no way to recourse, no way to discuss and apply judgment to the things that the caller described may be punishing or not. So that is something that could be lost.
Howie, do you have any something to add?
I have nothing to add to that.
Okay, let's go to see if we can get our last call in this hour. Let's go to Rochester, New York. Hi, Mike. Welcome.
Thank you. Great show.
Thank you.
So my concern is, as automation continues to progress, how are we going to restructure our world so it works for everybody?
Small topic. Well, it is a worldwide, the Earth is flat. The world is flat now. Do you think about this, James, at McKinsey?
I actually do, and I thank the caller for asking the question, because I think it depends what we're trying to solve for. Because on the one hand, if we're trying to solve for work, meaning are there things for people to do, I think there'll be plenty of things for people to do. But if the question is how do we solve for things like incomes and wages, that may be a slightly different question. Because one of the things that happens, by the way, economically, is that as people work in a way that's augmented with technology, in many instances, not all, but in many instances, that sometimes has a depressive effect on the wages for the person working with the technology. Not always. So the question is, if we're trying to solve for other things for people to do, I think that's an easier thing to solve for. But if we're trying to solve for incomes and standards of living and so forth, that becomes much more problematic. We may have to think about, you know, when much of the work driving output in the economy is being done by machines, what wage models look like in that world? And that's a big question. And I think it gets to some fundamental, sometimes ideological questions about work, wages, and incomes.
Yeah, it's being debated, and certainly in this political season. I thank both of you for taking time with us today. James Manyika is a senior partner at McKinsey & Company and director of the McKinsey Global Institute in San Francisco. Howie Choset is a professor of robotics at Carnegie Mellon in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Thank you both for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you. Ira.
You're welcome. Have a good weekend. BJ Lederman composed our theme music, and our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. If you missed any part of our program, you can go to our website and listen to it there, or subscribe to our podcast. And if you like us, we're there all week on Facebook, and we have a continuing week-long discussion going on all the time at SciFry on Twitter. So hope you stay cool this weekend. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.